Welcome to BioCentury This Week, the podcast with BioCentury's editorial team talking all things biopharma. I'm Jeff Cranmer, one of the executive editors here at BioCentury, and joining me today are my colleagues.
Simon Fishburne, editor-in-chief.
Steve Osden, Washington editor.
Selena Koch, executive editor.
On today's podcast, the latest on anti-China bills making their way through Congress. Diversity. Is it a dirty word now? And a major setback for Amylyx's ALS therapy. And we wrap up with a look at what may be on FDA's agenda as the agency calls for a panel on Lilly's new Alzheimer's therapy. All right, let's kick things off. Steve, when we spoke last week, as you were coming back to the office from the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party's hearing about biotech and national security, I honestly thought you had skipped out on the meeting and saw a Marvel movie. What on earth happened at that meeting?
Well, I want to back up a little bit. So two things happened last week, right? Before that committee met, the day before, the Senate Homeland Security Committee met to mark up or vote on S-3558, which now has a name, the Prohibiting Foreign Access to American Genetic Information Act. And it passed it in an almost unanimous vote. Only one vote against, Senator Rand Paul. And he was uncharacteristically restrained in explaining his reasoning for not voting for it. Quickly, the bill was modified from the original version. It still seeks to drive Chinese biotech companies, BGI, MGI, Complete Genomics, and WuXi AppTec, out of the United States. It doesn't mention WuXi Biologics, but it has provisions that would almost certainly include WuXi Biologics. The big change is that projects that are underway at the time that the bill is enacted would be grandfathered in. They wouldn't be affected. But other than that, it would basically drive these companies out of the United States. So as you said separately, yeah, the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party in the House had a hearing last week. It was both farcical and deeply serious. The farcical part came right at the start. The committee chairman, Mike Gallagher, warned that China is working on genetic enhancement of soldiers for the People's Liberation Army, that genetically tailored weapons are already, quote, a trending topic, whatever that means, in PLA military circles. And he said that China is executing a plan to collect the DNA of every man, woman, and child on the planet. The ranking Democrat on the committee, Representative Roger Krishnamurthy, also said that the CCP is conducting human experiments to give soldiers biologically enhanced capabilities today. He did show a graphic from a Marvel comic movie and said, it's not just in the movies, it's not just Captain America, it's really happening over there in China. And he also added that, quote, according to some reports, China's even researching mind-reading software to ensure that CCP officials remain loyal to the party. You know, Gallagher's main point, setting aside the science fiction, he said that every bit of value flowing to Chinese biotech or genetic science companies will be used to strengthen the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army. And echoing a Cold War slogan, he said, we cannot afford to keep funding our own destruction. I think he's misreading history, and I actually have written a book about part of this history, about the Soviet Union's technological competition with the United States. It's called Engineering Communism, and you can find it at online booksellers. There are big differences between China and the Soviet Union, and the Cold War with the Soviet Union and U.S. rivalry with China. Two big important differences. The Soviet Union didn't innovate. They were risk-averse, and they only invested in technology that had been proven in the West. That doomed them. The second is that the Soviets put almost all their R&D into the military. China's not making either of those mistakes. The part of the hearing that was deeply serious was testimony about what the U.S. should do to ensure that it retains preeminence in biotechnology. And we can talk about that. But I thought that was really important.
So I think there's a fundamental difference also in that the arms race was literally about creating products that destroy, whereas the healthcare ecosystem is about creating products that save lives and make people's lives better. So that conflation and that analogy really, really stings, to be quite honest. But I think, you know, this is not really a laughing matter because it's got real world implications. And the idea that, apart from the fact that our governing body, or the US's governing body, is living in this world of make-believe is quite alarming. You sort of hope that their feet are on the ground or a little bit better versed in reality for other things that they're legislating on. But the other point that you raise very eloquently in your editorial, Steve, it shouldn't really be about warding off China's innovation so much as about focusing on what can be done and building, you talk about US preeminence, but building that up, or Western preeminence, as a feature in itself. So maybe talk a little bit about your argument there.
So Tara O'Toole from InQtel said some very interesting things about that. And she pointed to BGI Genomics, and said that one of the complaints that the members of Congress have, or the concerns that they had, is that they're building massive genomic databases. And what she said is, look, the United States should be doing that. The United States should be creating massive, the world's largest genomic database. It's not. BGI is. And she said, shame on us for not doing that. Other people who testified there, Jason Kelly from Ginkgo Bioworks, pointed out that there's a tremendous need for the United States to invest in biomanufacturing. If the United States wants to be the world's leader and to stay the world's leader in biotechnology, or if the West writ large wants to, it has to have the capability to manufacture biologics here. And I think that gets to one of the key issues in this legislation that's working its way through Congress, which is that it would put the United States at a competitive disadvantage if the United States kicks Chinese manufacturers, biomanufacturers out at a time when the United States doesn't have, and the West generally doesn't have, the capacity, the capability to make up for that capacity that they would lose from that. So a lot of the more serious talk at the hearing was about what the United States needs to do to retain and to expand its biomanufacturing and to have the kinds of capabilities that the Chinese CDMOs are providing to American companies now. So then you could have a discussion about, a better discussion about whether the United States should take actions to protect its markets or to be more concerned about access to proprietary data and so on.
Well, certainly cutting off an avenue, an important avenue for manufacturing before you have actually replicated or found alternative source sounds very, very damaging. But I sort of have a question for you, Steve, because, you know, the UK put together the UK Biobank how many years ago? 10 years ago, something like that. And that biobank is used by drug developers all over the world. I hear them citing it all the time. The US has done a certain amount of projects, the All of Us genomes project, there's various other ones, but I've never really heard of anything that seems to have got this global impact in that way. And why is it? What's held the US back from creating these kinds of databases until now?
So that was another thing that Tara O'Toole talked about, which was that the United States has put almost all of its public investment in science in basic research and very little in translational research. And she called for a shift. She said the United States needs to do more to fund translational research, like massive databases or clinical trials, modernizing the clinical trials paradigm in the United States. You can think of other things, you know, investing in translational science to improve the way that gene therapy vectors are manufactured, for example, or cell therapies are manufactured. Those are things that would involve public-private partnerships. The government can't do it by itself. Industry can't do it by itself. It would need investments of expertise and money from both sides, and it would be something that would create a platform for prosperity.
All right. Thanks for that, Steve. And Steve has also written a children's book on the 2016 presidential election. That one did not get published, but it brought me endless joy. We had another editor's commentary last week. Simone took a close look at the state of DEI in biotech. Simone?
So, Jeff, I'll be honest, this was something that's been on my mind a lot, and International Women's Day felt like a good time to, should we say, get it off my chest. The issue is this: DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, has been to some degree controversial for quite a while, actually. There was this massive boost after, in particular, the death of George Floyd, but it's been in many companies and in many academic institutions core as a way to try and level the playing field for people who, women and minorities, who have generally been kind of locked out of the plum positions and the paths to the plum positions of influence and power. And so it was sort of built as a corrective action. There've been people along the way who've always thought that it's sort of like affirmative action, that it tips the odds, it's against free market principles. But many, many people buy into the general idea behind it. What sort of happened in the last few months, in particular since that shameful congressional testimony of the presidents of Harvard, MIT, and University of Pennsylvania, and various things going on along U.S. campuses, is it's almost as if the lid's been blown off on DEI. And it's really been understood now to work along these very, very rigid parameters that of just either aggressors and victims or privileged and disenfranchised, these very binary axes. And as a consequence, I won't go into all of the details now, most of the focus has been on anti-Semitism, but as a consequence, there's really been a lot of inconsistencies and hypocrisy in that movement, and it's losing, there's a huge backlash against it. And even though I actually have a lot of problems with the institutionalization of DEI, I think there's a real danger that people will go, you see, it was all a sham, and what I say, throw diversity out with the DEI bathwater. I think it's really important to separate the goals of diversity and what it aims to do, and to keep that core in companies, biotechs, and obviously universities as well, to the mission. I think that there's a wealth of evidence that diverse teams perform better. And I think that there are still a lot of barriers that need to be overcome.
So I think it was interesting, Simone. You quoted an interview that I did with Rob Perez, and he, I thought, made a very important point, which is he said, you can separate out, for the biotech industry especially, or any industry, you can separate out the kind of ideological or political reasons why people may or may not support diversity. He said, put those aside and just think of what's good for people's businesses. And he said, there's a business case for diversity, that there's a distribution of talent that's going to be across populations. And if you cut yourself off from large parts of the population because you're not recruiting from them, then you're going to be missing talent that you need to succeed or to outcompete other companies. I thought that was a really interesting point. It's a way of kind of taking some of the tension out of the whole issue.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, there are people, Steve, who still believe that just talent will rise. You don't have to do anything to encourage it. And if they're, you know, if anybody is that good, they will get discovered and that the market will find it. But we know that's not the case because the numbers belie that. Something that I also find problematic is individuals who might sometimes not have been given a position, either on a board or an executive team, will often sort of say, well, I'm too white for that, or they won't take a male. And, you know, that's just not true. The numbers don't bear that out either. I think at some point you have to accept two things. One is maybe you weren't the best candidate. And the other is, and something that Rob Perez also points to, is that in a diversity per se has value, Rob and other people, that your perspective, as you point out, you know, from different experiences that you may have had, brings value to a company. And I think there's another thing that he pointed out that really struck me, which is he talked about this, a term he used, which is energy tax. And he says for, and I think this is really important, and comes to the point of how people should sort of think about moving, you know, creating better environments. He says, if you are what he called not different, right? If you are of the majority in the room, in a meeting, you'll just say what you think. He said, when you are different, he didn't define different, but when you're an outlier, when you're different, you think twice and three times before you say something. You think, how will this be perceived? Am I too, you know, I know women, you know, am I too aggressive? Am I too outspoken? Am I too this? Or to that. And he says, over the lifetime of a career, that's exhausting when you have to, you know, he thinks about that as the amount of energy you have to put into something. And I can tell you, I already had people reach back out to me after we published this saying, oh my gosh, that's so spot on. And I think, you know, it resonates for many people. And so I think that one of the thoughts here is that companies and individuals need not to be thinking along the DEI very rigid binary axes and box checking and just making sure they have those numbers. You have to hire qualified individuals. You have to include merit. When you hire them, though, you have to create an environment that allows them to actually contribute and do their job. And if you've got an environment that imposes this energy tax where people are frightened to speak up and say their opinion, you really haven't harnessed that diversity at all.
All right. Thanks for that, Simone. Simone's editor's commentary, along with Steve's, is up on biocentury.com. It's in front of the paywall. You can also find Steve's conversation on the BioCentury show with Rob Perez, the head of Life Science Cares. He's also an operating partner at General Atlantic. And you can also catch our most recent episode of the BioCentury show. Steve speaks with bioethicist Arthur Kaplan on compassionate use, the Josh Hardy case, and many other topics. We're now going to take a short break, and we'll come back to talk drug development.
For more than 20 years, BioEquity Europe has been where CEOs and investors gather to network, partner, and debate critical issues facing the biotech industry. In 2024, BioEquity heads to San Sebastian, Spain, in Basque Country, May 12 to 14th. Join BioCentury, EBD Group, and Regional Host Committee Chair, ICEOS Capital, in one of the world's culinary capitals. Don't wait, last year's BioEquity conference sold out. Visit bioequityeurope.com for more information.
Amylyx's ALS therapy has failed its pivotal trial. Selena, let me bring you into the conversation here. These were highly anticipated data. What happened?
They were highly anticipated because it was a highly unusual situation. What happened was this was a therapy that, based on a single phase two trial, got full approval after two advisory committees. So the first meeting, FDA's own reviewers brought a litany of concerns about the analytical and statistical methods that in the phase two trial that made them think it was not persuasive. In the second meeting, Billy Dunn came in, who is in the director of the neuroscience office, and tried to recast the sort of tone and to say, look, in this disease, which is incredibly devastating, for which there are no effective treatments, we need to apply maximum regulatory flexibility. And one of the levers we have is to approve something based on a single trial with some supportive evidence. And based on the gravity of the disease, we need to keep that as first in our minds. And through that lens, you should look at these data. And that was enough to sway some of the panelists, just enough of the panelists to have a positive vote on that one, and ultimately it gets approval. So now, because a lot of people saw this as maybe a precedent or one way that FDA intends to apply flexibility, a lot of people are asking, did it make the right call? And if it didn't, what could have happened differently that would have been better?
And right? And one of the things also that was unique here, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, is that FDA asked the company if they would agree in advance to voluntarily withdraw the drug if it failed the phase three trial, because this was a full approval, not an accelerated approval, which means that FDA, it's much, much, much more difficult for FDA to actually force the company to withdraw it.
That's exactly right. So it had a few options, right? There was a phase three trial underway. The agency could have said, you know what, we're not going to make a decision right now. We're going to wait till we have those data. Could have found a way to give an accelerated approval where you have at least the premise of that system is that there is a way to then take it off the market. Although we've seen it's not always that easy, but it's easier. And then the approach they actually took was just going ahead with the full approval, which is the hardest approach to then take it off the market.
And in my opinion, there's another lever that they should have reached, they could have reached for, and they should have reached for, which is expanded access, which has also been called compassionate use. That's a program where individuals or groups can get access to an unapproved drug. Usually the companies don't charge for those drugs. There are some parameters that allow them to charge their costs for the drug, but usually they don't do that. This was a situation that was tailor-made for a large-scale expanded access protocol. There was a phase two data that was promising enough for many ALS patients and physicians to believe that they should get access to the drug. Their condition was urgent enough that they didn't want to wait. There didn't seem to be serious safety risks. Amylyx had a phase three trial with data that was going to read out quite rapidly. So they could have said, look, everybody that wants it and feels that they need it can get access to it on an expanded access basis until there's an approval, and then we'll switch over to selling it commercially. That would have cost the company something. It costs something to me to run an expanded access protocol. And of course, they would have foregone the revenues that they've received between the end of the phase two trial and the readout from the phase three trial. But I would argue that everybody would have been better off if they had done that. And the fact that FDA didn't do that, I think, chips away at the confidence, not only of the public, but of payers in its decisions. If there's one thing to say regulatory flexibility means that they're going to take into consideration the fact that something is a rare disease, for example, or even an ultra rare disease, and take that into consideration in assessing the data. What it shouldn't mean is that they're just taking a risk or a gamble. And if it comes out wrong, then they're hoping the company will do the right thing and take the drug off the market. And if it comes out right, then they're celebrated. People look at this and say, oh, well, they could have been right. And if they had been right, then people would have gotten access to this drug months and months earlier than they would have if you'd waited for the end of the phase three trial. And to me, again, that's exactly what expanded access is intended for.
So, Steve, I have a couple of questions about that. So it's very clear, given the amount of research that's going on into and new opportunities in rare diseases and so on, this is going to come up. It's going to come up more and again, because there will, and it doesn't even have to be just rare diseases, to be quite honest. I mean, there are always some very compelling stories where there's absolutely no opportunities and FDA is sort of going to be inclined, or I don't know if they're going to be inclined, FDA is going to be under pressure to create options where there are none, even in the absence of very forceful evidence. In fact, we saw that right with aducanumab, right? So the question really is, what's it going to look like from now? And the second part of that is, how much has this created a precedent? How much has FDA dug a hole here where people can say, well, you've got a precedent based on that. You have to do it again now.
Well, I think that what it actually does is it creates an imperative for FDA to define regulatory flexibility and not just to say, well, it's something, to paraphrase the Supreme Court.
We'll know it when we see it.
Exactly. It's not just something, we know it when we see it. They need to put real parameters around what regulatory flexibility means and when it should be used, because certainly there are instances when it definitely should be used. At the same time, I think that the fact that there's compelling need shouldn't be in itself a reason for FDA to approve something in the absence of compelling data. And again, there needs to be a way out. And I think that the way out in many cases is going to be expanded access. Of course, the companies won't like it because they don't get reimbursed for it, but it also keeps the pressure on for them to generate the data that can be used to get an approval, either an accelerated approval or a full approval.
Is there a need, Steve, for a sweetener for companies?
In the case of ALS, there are NIH funds.
Exactly. The ALS community lobbied Congress, got a bill passed that exactly envisions these circumstances and allows for companies to be reimbursed for drugs that are distributed through an expanded access program. So there is a precedent for sweeteners. And I would say in the case of Amylyx, I'm not sure that they needed any kind of a sweetener. Wall Street was expecting $1 billion in revenues from this drug if it had worked the way that the company and patients and everybody hoped that it would. So waiting a few more months and giving away drug for a few months wasn't going to sink the company. It wasn't going to drive an investment out. They could have afforded to do that. There are circumstances where the call might be much, much more difficult because the company wouldn't have the resources to do that. Or maybe it's something where it's a biologic where it's far, far more expensive to manufacture. But in this case, the drug didn't cost much to manufacture. The company had solid backing from investors, and it wouldn't have been an existential crisis for them. And the timeline was close, right? Yeah, they didn't have to wait a very long time.
Selena, another topic that you follow closely for us here at BioCentury is Alzheimer's, everything from the earliest stages all the way to drugs hitting the market. Next up is Lilly Alzheimer's therapy, donanemab. FDA just scheduled an advisory committee meeting for the therapy, and it now looks like the therapy will miss its FDA decision date, which is this month. But I know you've said that the approval is not in doubt. What should we expect from this panel meeting?
Yeah, it's widely expected to be approved, and I don't think this changes that, right? The question is, what does FDA want to talk about? And we don't know exactly what that will be yet, but to me, the most valuable thing they could talk about is who this drug should be used in, and specifically whether the risk-benefit profile is positive for the subset of patients who have high levels of tau in the brain. I think Lilly should be commended here for doing really good science that pushes the field forward in terms of understanding the pathologies in the brain, how they progress, and how that relates to whether they're an appropriate patient for an amyloid mAb. But what they found suggests that there are a subset of patients within their trial who don't respond. Basically, what they did is, so most trials these days of anti-amyloid therapies will make sure that patients, in fact, have amyloid buildup in the brain. If you don't have the drug's target, the drug's not likely to work, right? But that's something they didn't know early on in the field. Now, in addition to that, Lilly added on another layer, which is that they did PET imaging for the other major pathology in Alzheimer's, which is tau. And they bucketed patients to whether they have low, medium, or high levels of tau. And that is because tau buildup happens after amyloid buildup, and it's a more closely tied to symptom onset. And so they thought, well, if this misses in the overall population, it might still meet in patients with lower amounts of tau, because once you're further along in the disease, further away from that primary insult, as a lot of companies believe amyloid is, it might be too late to treat with an anti-amyloid mAb. And, well, that's basically what they found.
So two questions, Selena. Mm-hmm. One is, or maybe three. My understanding is that Lilly found that, but they don't want that to be on the label. They don't want it to be a condition for use of the drug.
Correct.
And is there a read-through from this to lecanemab or perhaps to other drugs? Should all the drugs be thought of as working in this way? And three, do you think that then there should be a change in the paradigm for the way that people are diagnosed and the kind of preconditions for using these drugs?
Yeah, so that's the tough part. So yes, I think Leqembi and donanemab will share this same, you know. So Leqembi didn't do its trial this way, right? So its label is for all early stage patients. Lilly wants its label to also be for all early stage patients, and they stress that in that population, it met the endpoint. And it's only when you do this analysis of the high tau that you kind of see, well, it didn't really work there. And given that there's some serious side effects with these mAbs, you have to wonder then if that risk benefit still makes sense. You know,
Selena, though, do you think there's a danger that, I mean, in a way, Lilly's being penalized for doing the better study? And so, precision medicine, does that mean like, well, why do that analysis? We'd learn more about the biology, but it'll hurt us, right? We've had this conversation before about the commercial teams versus the R&D teams. So I think that's a little bit dangerous, actually.
I guess. It's still a massive population.
Yeah. It's not like there's not going to be a huge population that's going to...
I can guarantee you the commercial teams will not see it that way.
No,
they'll see it as this requires more. And basically, they did the better study. They found better biology. If they get a restricted label, and from a commercial point of view, it went against them.
Absolutely. And that's why they're trying... They put the high tau subgroup in the supplemental data. It wasn't the primary analysis, right? And the primary analysis was positive. Therefore, they think they should get the whole label. And there's maybe some sense in which there'd be injustice if their label was more restricted than Leqembi, given that this is almost certainly true of Leqembi. And we did see some data at CTAB where they broke down that data by tau levels. They didn't have tau on everybody the way Lilly did. But you can certainly see that same trend is there. It's the earliest patients get the most benefit.
And there's another difference, isn't there, which is that Lilly is defining a period of time when people should get the therapy versus Biogen and Eisai, who are basically saying that once people get on it, it's not at all clear when they should stop.
Yeah, so that ties into actually your third one from before, which is how are these things going to be monitored and used in the real world? So first of all, if it goes the way where FDA says, okay, in this high tau subpopulation, the risk benefit doesn't really work out, we're going to restrict the label, That means patients will have to have not only a PET imaging for amyloid, but PET imaging for tau as a precondition of using this drug. So PET imaging is not the most accessible, cheap thing you can do in the real world, right? It will.
But on the other hand, if you're a payer and you're now talking about a drug that wouldn't be forever, but would be finite, so you've got a trade-off between paying for that up front versus potentially another therapy where you've got to pay for it forever.
Right. So then the next piece of it is, okay, once you do the two biomarkers, you say this is good for this patient should get the drug, then you have to now, if this is a finite course of therapy, you have to continue to redo amyloid PET over and over until you see that they become negative and they meet the stopping criteria. And then it's going to start accumulating again at some rate. And you might wonder, when should I restart therapy? Perhaps I have to continue to do amyloid PET imaging.
All right. Well, I guess what I take home from this is A, credit to Lilly for doing the right experiment. Yeah. B, you basically need new therapies completely different than these to move the field forward to get out of these sort of very difficult paradigms.
Yeah. And blood tests that they're not quite there yet, but blood tests that are highly correlated with both of these measures would make it a lot easier.
And not to keep this going too long, but also ways to get these therapies to people really early.
This is really interesting stuff. I know Selena will be following that advisory committee meeting closely. And if you want to dig into her story, we published it on Friday and it's up on biocentury.com. Also coming soon on biocentury.com, we'll have the final installment in our colleague Karen Tkach-Tuzman's dive into the translational goodie bag that is the 2023 distillery. And Steve spoke to John Crowley about what's in store as he begins his tenure leading bio. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. We'll catch you next week. And as always, Kendall Square Orchestra provides the music for BioCentury this week.